ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, after announcing a new support scheme for kids with autism, the federal government tells the states they're expected to fund it too. Also, the Economic Reform Roundtable wraps up in Canberra, and two grassroots Melbourne soccer clubs dream of entering the A-League.
We've been ready for 20 years now. It'd be such a magnificent story for the A-League expansion to come from the Australian Championship and clubs that participate in the Australian Championship.
After announcing a new program to divert children with autism from the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS Minister, Mark Butler, has today shocked some state governments with a demand that they match the federal government's $2 billion of funding for the program. Mr. Butler wants the Thriving Kids Scheme to be rolled out across the country from 2027 to help cut the growth and expense of the NDIS. Experts are warning that's a tight timeframe, as Joanna Crothers reports.
Mark Butler was working hard on the airwaves today, spruiking his new initiative called Thriving Kids and explaining how it would work.
We've taken the view, with lots of expert advice, that the proper thing for those kids is a broad-based mainstream system of supports rather than a scheme built for permanent disability. Now, I've said over the next couple of years that is what we'll build, a system for thriving kids that is what parents and children need with that level of developmental delay and autism.
Thriving Kids will sit outside the NDIS and is aimed at supporting children with mild to moderate autism and developmental delays. Part of the reasoning is that it will divert them away from the NDIS, helping the scheme remain financially sustainable. Several state governments say they hadn't heard about the program before it was announced.
Well, we have been talking about it, so it's not really that they didn't know. Certainly part of the foundational supports that were recommended to National Cabinet by the NDIS review, the review of the scheme 22 and 23. But the feedback that we had got from states over the last 12 or 18 months was they didn't think the Commonwealth was leaning in enough.
So one big question is, will the states and territories come to the negotiating table with support and, more importantly, with funding? New South Wales Premier Chris Minns says it's a major piece of reform and he needs time to consider it.
I can't sign a blank cheque. I'm not going to commit sight unseen, but we will commit to working with the Commonwealth Government to have a sustainable disability support program right across the country, and New South Wales, of course, will do its bit.
In Victoria, Premier Jacinta Allan says she doesn't want the new scheme to strip support from families who are already struggling.
I can only speak here on behalf of Victoria. Any change that is being proposed from the federal government must not compromise the supports we are already providing to families here in Victoria.
The position of the South Australian, West Australian and Queensland governments is also unclear, but they say they'll continue to work with the federal government. Today, the federal opposition was keen to highlight the unsustainable growth that's plagued the NDIS. Shadow Minister for Health and Aged Care, Anne Rustin.
We still don't know what's happening with foundational supports, which was an announcement about a change to the NDIS program last year. So we've got another announcement with no details and no certainty and no pathway through by which the minister has announced that he's actually going to deliver what he said. So it's created great uncertainty for families of these children.
The reaction of the states and territories underlines how big a task the federal government faces. Helen Dickinson is a professor in public service research at the University of New South Wales, Sydney. She says the idea of states and territories being responsible for what's called foundational supports, which the Thriving Kids program is an example of, was first talked about 2 years ago. It was a conversation that resulted in the states and territories saying they couldn't commit to the funding and logistical arrangements.
Really, over the last year or so, there's been quite a fractious relationship has developed between the states and territories and the federal government around how these things are going to work. And they were supposed to be in place already, but they've struggled to give that traction.
She doubts the timeline given by the NDIS Minister Mark Butler for the program to begin by July next year is realistic. Dr. Jessica Painter is an associate professor and clinical psychologist from the School of Applied Psychology at Griffith University. She's worked with children with autism for almost two decades.
I think it's vital that the program is co-designed with autistic people, their families, and other autism stakeholders to make sure that we have something that meets their needs. And in doing so, we're not going to have a single solution. What we need is to have a series or a set of resources available.
Clinical psychologist Dr. Jessica Painter from Griffith Uni. That report from Joanna Crothers. The Federal Treasurer's Economic Reform Roundtable has wrapped up in Canberra this evening. Over the last 3 days, invited representatives of business, industry, unions, social service and environment groups have sat around the big cabinet table with lawmakers and economists to discuss issues including boosting the nation's productivity, tax reform and artificial intelligence. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, spoke a short time ago.
The best way to sustain and grow living standards over time is to make our economy more productive, to make it more resilient, and also to make sure that our budget is more sustainable. And these were the tasks that we set some terrific people who gave us their expertise and their experience over the course of the last few days. For all of us, higher living standards is the holy grail, and a more productive economy is how we deliver it.
Apart from Dr. Chalmers and the Shadow Treasurer Ted O'Brien, the independent MP Allegra Spender was the only other politician invited to be part of the roundtable, and I spoke to her a little earlier. Allegra Spender, do you think this roundtable has achieved anything?
Look, I think it's been a really positive process. It's been a really useful place to build common ground and to deal with some tricky issues, AI being one of them. I think it's really clear that there was a real meeting of minds on the need to protect Australian creatives and still manage, you know, the AI opportunity. And I think that's just an example of where common ground was found by bringing people together.
But the word coming out of the roundtable, the reports at least, were that the ACTU, the union movement, got a fair bit of resistance to its push to have better regulation of AI. Was that your perspective?
Look, I think where I saw that was, you know, they have a view on how to solve, you know, concerns about AI regulation. And what I heard was that, okay, let's look at the gaps, let's look at the specifics and see where the concerns are and then, you know, decide whether an AI act or whether it can be dealt with within existing legislation. So I think that there's a lot of detail to be ironed out after this. But I think what it was an exchange, and I think of putting concerns on different angles on the table so that policy development from now can be nuanced with those concerns fed in.
Tax reform was on the agenda for the final session this afternoon, and that's something you've been pushing for over the last few years. What did you tell the roundtable you think needs to be done?
Look, what I said to the roundtable was that we need to deal with some urgent, I think, really important issues in our tax system. We need a tax system that makes sure every generation can thrive, like previous generations. And we also need a tax system that drives and incentivizes growth and investment in our businesses. And, you know, there are different options I put out there. I certainly talked about how do we reduce the burden on tax on work and, you know, how do we rebalance that towards, you know, perhaps taxes on passive income? Because it is important. And I think that people did really acknowledge that tax has a really important role to play. I think the Treasurer was brave to put tax on the agenda, and I think it was the right decision.
Do you think we're going to see some tax reform?
Look, I've never expected tax reform out of this afternoon, but what I hope is we'll see, and we'll see what the Treasurer says ultimately. I hope to see that there's at least a movement towards, you know, some sort of process or movement in towards of making sure that tax reform doesn't just get kicked down the road for future generations.
Ms. Spender, what do you think were the most contentious issues discussed at the roundtable where perhaps not so much progress was made?
I think perhaps in something like the housing debate, there was a bit of a debate about national construction codes and people had different views on that. The government, I think, will choose to move forward there, but it was an appropriate exchanging of ideas. I think it is, from my point of view, I thought there has been some good movement made on how can we make regulations still protect people, but simpler so we can build more houses. And I think that was a pretty good balance where the government's going on that. But there were some concerns raised and we'll see where the government ends up.
a very diverse group on this round table, and journalists weren't allowed in the cabinet room to witness the discussions. I'm sure a lot of listeners are interested to know, what was the mood like in the room over the last few days?
It was actually really pretty good. I think there's a huge amount of respect that people have for each other. There was quite a lot of laughing at, odd bits of laughing, I wouldn't say quite a lot. But I think most people listen respectively and engage very, very respectively. And I think people, where they saw that there was common ground, were really good at acknowledging that. So I think it was a really positive piece as well for building relationships across that, particularly that sort of community, social, business sector as well.
Which issues are you confident we'll see action on from here?
Well, look, I think we will definitely move, I hope, on the Environmental Protection Act. I expect we will definitely move on homes and regulations. I think we should also definitely move on skills, and particularly things like, you know, prioritising some areas of occupational licensing, which is basically so people can use their skills to the fullest amount. You know, that's a bit tricky, but we should work on some prioritisation areas. And I'll be keep on pushing. You know, obviously, tax reform is really important to me, but also access to small business finance, where we had a good discussion, but I think there's definitely more work to do.
Allegra Spender is the independent MP for the Sydney seat of Wentworth. Well, if you ever scroll through social media and come across a celebrity endorsement that seems too good to be true, beware. Chances are it's a scam. Australia's corporate watchdog ASIC has just got expanded powers to take down those dodgy ads to protect people from being fleeced. Kimberly Price prepared this report.
What's up, Australia?
If you had to guess, do you think this ad is real or fake?
I'm excited to be on the ABC tonight talking about my new health regimen. It's got amazing results.
That voice might sound familiar, but it's not the real George Clooney. It's created with artificial intelligence, and that ad is a scam. If you were fooled, you're not alone.
My great uncle friended me on Facebook, and he was sending me these messages, and I was like, wow, I'm having a really nice conversation with my great uncle.
On the streets of Adelaide, these people have had their own run-ins with social media scams.
And then he was like, oh, you should totally like do this scheme thing. And I was like, oh.
Someone said they fell in love with me from United States.
So I received a message on Messenger that they can help me financially and I have to fill the form. And I did it and I realised it was a scam.
And they want someone to do something about the spread of these fake ad scams.
It's scary, and especially for older people. I don't know what to say. I'm very scared, very sceptic.
In general, social media companies have a lot of freedom to post like harmful material, and they don't regulate it very well. And so I think this is one example of where they do need to have more regulation.
Because they historically have so bad at, especially with AI, working out what's allowed, what's not allowed. But I think more needs to be done, 100%, because like this is people being taken advantage of, and that's not okay.
Well, if I catch them, they ought to lock them up.
Fake advertisements can take the shape of videos, images and articles, and have been known to spruik everything from diet tablets to cryptocurrencies on social media. Now, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, ASIC, is taking stronger action. Alan Kirkland is the commissioner.
We have engaged a business that specialises in this, and what they do when we ask them to take down a website is they reach out to the hosting provider. So that might be a provider that's hosting the scam website in another part of the world, and we ask them to take it down. And I guess they're not legally required to do that, but we found that they are extremely cooperative.
Since launching this takedown in July 2023, more than 14,000 investment scams and phishing websites have been knocked out, with around 130 malicious sites removed by ASIC every week.
We're trying to stop this one step earlier in the process. We're reaching out to Meta, which runs those platforms, and getting them to take down the ads.
The federal government is introducing new legislation putting more obligations on social media platforms. While that's yet to go through, Alan Kirkland believes ASIC is starting to make social media companies take scams more seriously.
Meta has agreed to take down ads where we reach out to them, but that's dependent on us identifying that there is an ad that's promoting an investment scam website. And if we do that and reach out, they've agreed to take it down. But I think the government, through its new legislation, has also recognised that social media platforms need to do a lot more.
Monica Whitty is a professor of human factors in cybersecurity at Monash University. She believes it's up to both both social media companies and the government to regulate scams.
A multi-pronged approach is important, but sometimes a bit of stick to make sure that the social media sites are actually looking after the users is really important as well.
Too good to be true financial schemes play a major role in reported scams in Australia, making up almost half of all those reported losses in 2024. And ASIC has taken down more than 8,000 fake investment platforms and over 3,000 cryptocurrency scams.
Scammers do look for the latest trend, but what we also need to understand about cryptocurrency scams and why they are so effective is, yes, it's more popular to use cryptocurrency, but people don't understand how to use it. So they think, yes, I'd like to make an investment. They believe that it's going to be a nice, quick investment. That's actually not true.
To ensure you don't fall for a scam, Professor Whitty believes there's some simple actions to apply.
Whatever you do, don't act quickly. It's that impulsivity to think, oh, this is a great deal, I'll miss out on it, that actually gets people in. So take your time, take a few steps backwards, do some research.
Scams can be reported online via the ASIC website.
That report from Kimberly Price and Luke Radford. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, two grassroots Melbourne soccer clubs dreaming of elevation to the A-League. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has stepped up his attack on his Australian counterpart, saying Anthony Albanese is forever tarnished now that his government plans to recognise a Palestinian state. At the same time, Israel is defiantly staring down international condemnation of both its approval of controversial new settlements in the West Bank and its push to expand its occupation of the Gaza Strip. Israel's military says troops are on the outskirts of Gaza City and ready to advance. Rachel Mealy reports.
Benjamin Netanyahu isn't holding back, telling us what he thinks about the Australian Prime Minister.
Well, look, I'm sure he has a reputable record as a public servant, but I think his record is forever tarnished by the weakness that he showed in the face of these Hamas terrorist monsters.
In an interview to be aired in full on Sky News tonight, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives voice to his previous written criticism of Anthony Albanese.
You know, when the worst terrorist organization on earth, these savages who murdered women, raped them, beheaded men, burnt babies alive in front of their parents and took hundreds of hostages, when these people congratulate the Prime Minister of Australia, you know something is wrong.
The Israeli Prime Minister is angry about the federal government's imminent plan to recognise a Palestinian state. Last week, the Australian government announced its plan to join Canada, the UK and France in formally recognising Palestinian statehood at next month's United Nations meeting. But as the war of words plays out, the Israeli Defence Force says it's moved troops into position on the outskirts of Gaza City and is ready to advance. These explosions were heard overnight in Gaza. They came as the Israeli military spokesperson, Brigadier General Effie Defran, confirmed that Israel plans to take over Gaza City.
In accordance with the guidance of the political leadership, and after the plans were approved by the Chief of Staff, the IDF has begun the second phase of the campaign.
The Israeli Defence Force says Gaza City is a stronghold of Hamas and describes the terrorist organisation as a battered and bruised guerrilla force. The move prompted UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
I must reiterate that it is vital to reach immediately a ceasefire in Gaza and the unconditional release of all hostages, and to avoid the massive deaths and destruction that a military operation against Gaza City would inevitably cause.
Secretary General Guterres is calling on Israel to reverse a decision to expand an illegal settlement construction in the occupied West Bank known as the E1 project.
The decision by the Israeli authorities to expand illegal settlement construction, which would divide the West Bank, must be reversed. all settlement construction is a violation of international law.
Ian Parmeter is a research scholar at the Australian National University's Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies.
This E1 development is really very large. It's 12 square kilometres. It's a very large settlement area. It will have about 3,500 apartments and will effectively complete a circle of settlements, illegal settlements, around East Jerusalem. So it will be a very significant point when it's built.
He says Israel's new settlement approval pushes a two-state solution toward impossibility, and that means the long-term ability for Israel to call itself a Jewish state is compromised.
In destroying the prospects for a two-state solution, they're actually heading towards a one-state solution. And a one-state solution would be very bad for Israel, because it would essentially make Israel and the Israeli and Palestinian populations of the one state pretty well equal. And Israel would have to give civil and political rights to the Palestinians, and it could no longer be then termed a Jewish state.
Ian Parmeter from the ANU's Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies. Rachel Mealy, the reporter. In soccer leagues around the world, lowly ranked clubs fight to rise to the top tier competitions. That opportunity doesn't come up often in Australia's smaller football market. But with current Melbourne A-League team Western United likely to be dropped from the competition because of financial problems, two of the city's grassroots soccer clubs are hoping they'll take its place. Tom Maddox filed this story.
Albano to give Preston the lead!
For 78 years, the Preston Lions have been the heart of the local community in Melbourne's northern suburbs. Founded by Macedonian immigrants as a place to gather and connect, the club once graced the national stage in the 1980s and 90s, but in recent years, it's battled away in lower leagues. David Svetkovsky, whose dad took him to matches as a kid, is now club president.
The one thing we knew with this place was we have the supporters. This place has a heart. It has history. How many of the A-League clubs can say they've got 78 years of history and three generations of grandfather, you know, son and daughter or grandchildren coming to the one game?
The club climbed back to the top of the National Premier Leagues in Victoria, where it re-established a rivalry with South Melbourne, a club that has long dominated the state competition.
Lights, camera, action. The curtain rises on Victoria's showpiece fixture.
In round five this year, more than 9,000 screaming fans packed Preston's stands when the two sides clashed in a fixture dubbed the Big Show.
Brooks wants it on the far side. Leighton Brooks! Leighton Brooks brings the house down!
That closeness of a suburban ground, the vibe that night was simply electric.
But now both clubs are dreaming of something bigger. They believe they're ready to be promoted to Australia's top football competition, the A-League. And what's got them sensing opportunity is the fact that a current A-League club looks like it's about to fall over. Western United is based in Melbourne's West and is struggling for survival, despite becoming men's champions just 3 years ago. Now Western United is in financial turmoil and has been stripped of its A-League licence. So, could one of the city's grassroots clubs step up? Nick Marcusis is South Melbourne president.
We've been ready for 20 years now and have made a number of applications. We bring success, we bring excellence in football and a real passion for it.
The club has made several attempts to enter the A-League. In its last bid, the club lost out to Western United, which entered the competition in 2018 as part of an expansion. Preston's president, David Svetkovsky, says any new A-League club can have a stadium or financial backing. It must also have a cultural pulse.
For any club just to come about and create a new identity, brand connection, and that link to passion is not easy.
Football Australia says it already gives local clubs the chance to excel. It points to the Australian Championship, which is a season-long tournament including clubs from different levels, designed to, quote, connect the football pyramid in Australia and elevate aspirational clubs to the national stage.
We'll set up the bicycle! Oh my God! Max Mikula with one of the great South Melbourne goals!
Tom Maddox with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Australia's productivity may be among the worst in the developed world, but do we even understand the root cause of the problem? Today, Chief Business Correspondent Ian Verinder on the key factors the experts in Canberra aren't even considering. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.